Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives.
Hello, my dear.
Hello. So I know that you are struggling a little bit today. We're back to recording long distance just for this one.
Yeah, I was not feeling well on Thursday, so I couldn't hang to do a whole other episode. So we decided to wait until I was maybe feeling a little better and then record separately on Sunday. I still feel like hell, but here we are.
Here we are. We're doing
here we
thing.
Are. We're I'm alive. Yeah, I have somewhat of a voice, so here we are.
Yeah, and what we're going to be talking about today, I feel like, is very important.
Yes.
And in doing my prep for this episode, I was really glad that I was learning so much about this topic. But I do want to go ahead and straight from the jump give a huge trigger warning for...
Huge, huge trigger warning, yes.
Yes, because this subject is really, really heartbreaking, really, really sad. And I'm kind of appalled that we don't talk about it more, although as we move through this episode, it will become pretty clear as to
yeah.
why we don't know as much about this as maybe we should,
right.
Because it was only pretty recently that this began being talked about openly, kind of at all.
Definitely.
And that subject that we're going to be talking about today is the quote-unquote comfort women.
Yes.
I hate that.
I do too.
Term,
and I'm glad that in most of the notes that I read, in most of the articles, comfort women was often in quotes, which I appreciate because I understand that that's what they were called at the time, but it has nothing to do with what these women were to the men at that time. You know what I mean? They weren't like, it makes it sound too nice by calling them comfort
women. It does.
You know?
Yes, it does.
So,
and that is, it's based on like a Japanese translation, essentially.
It's like a euphemism,
mm-hmm.
yeah, for a word we don't typically use, but for prostitute. It's kind of like I wrote the Japanese word, I'm going to butcher it, I'm so sorry, yanfu, which I guess is the euphemism, and so that was why it's translated to comfort women. So the comfort women were women and girls forced into sexual slavery by the Imperial Japanese Army during World War II.
Right. I mean, and the reason why this kind of existed at all is because after the Second Sino-Japanese War, which was between 1937 and 1945, the Japanese had a PR problem. They had an
yeah.
image issue because there were atrocities that took place during that war. Specifically, there was one really, really terrible one. And again, I'm going to give a trigger warning throughout this entire section.
Yeah.
There was something called the Rape of Nanking. And it was one of the worst things I've read about. And if
it
you are going
horrible.
To look it up, if you're going to look up this massacre, you know, it's also called the Nanking Massacre.
Uh-huh.
If you're going to look it up on Wikipedia or whatever, I just want to give you a real trigger warning because there are pictures on Wikipedia that I was not expecting to see.
Yeah, it's
that are very, very graphic.
The number of women and girls who were assaulted during this time was somewhere between 20,000 and 80,000 women during this Nanking rape / massacre. So it really was just this horrible, widespread destruction.
Right. I mean, and it's not even, I mean, I can't emphasize enough how bad this was. I mean, you think about sexual assault and rape and you're like, that's bad enough. But this was more than that. It was brutal. It was
torture.
It was torture. Yeah, it was torture. These were disarmed combatants and unarmed Chinese civilians that were raped brutally and then often murdered and mutilated. So the Japanese soldiers would go door to door searching for girls and women specifically. And it was just madness. Like when
yeah.
people got there later and reported on it, of
right.
course, the world was horrified by what they found.
They ended up burying these, I mean, tens of thousands of people in these mass graves. So once people kind of learned what happened in Nanking, the whole world was so horrified by what they were seeing and hearing about. And the Emperor Kirihito was concerned about Japan's image after that catastrophe. Like you said, they were having a bit of a PR problem.
Right. So he wanted to curb rising anti-Japanese sentiment as much as possible. And so that's when he ordered the military to expand its so-called comfort stations, in quote, or military brothels in an effort to prevent further atrocities like this. That's what he said, right? He's like, we want to prevent this kind of thing from happening again. It's such a weird logic.
Well, it is, because he's thinking that it's sexual repression. Like, these men haven't had enough sex.
Right.
So that's why they went out and they raped all these women and girls. So that's where this whole thing starts off on the absolute wrong foot, because it's a misunderstanding of what sexual assault is. And then there was also a huge number of people coming down with venereal diseases. And that was another thing that was seen as very shameful. So they, in this emperor's head and the Japanese military's head at the time, if we could kind of control the women that these men were with, then we wouldn't be having as many venereal diseases and things like that as well.
Right. And I also think that there was an element of, as much as they wanted to be like, oh, we're going to control them from raping women.
Yeah.
I also think that there was a element of also not caring if they raped these women, because what they really wanted to control was their image. And so what they thought was, if we could have it all in a government institution, then word won't get out. We'll be able to protect the spread of whatever happens here. So
it's not going to be random civilians where it's going to reach the news. It's going to be secret. It's going to be kept under wraps. It's going to be less people. It's going to be more organized. It's not going to be this crazy massacre that happened before.
Right. And so the first military brothels, or quote unquote comfort stations, I'm going to refer to them in the way that they were referred, but just know that I hate the term comfort stations and comfort women.
Yes, we are
women.
Saying them with quotes every time we say
every time,
comfort
right.
anything. Just imagine quotation marks around our words.
Absolutely. So these first military brothels, or comfort stations as they would come to be known, were said to have been occupied initially by Japanese sex workers who volunteered for this service, but that would quickly change.
That wasn't enough. They didn't have enough women that wanted to do it, which, I mean, in my head, it's like, how many do you need? Like, it just, the whole concept of it is so crazy to me.
Well,
so the fact that they needed more than just the people that offered is crazy to me.
It seems like to me that it quickly, which as we know, I mean, of course, it got started off on the wrong foot because of a vast misunderstanding of the power dynamics at play and the reasons behind sexual assault and rape, because it wasn't about satisfying this need. It quickly became about power and control and what they could get away with. And they were permitted to get away with a lot. So very soon they were, again in quotes, recruiting women for the brothels by kidnapping or coercing them. So women were rounded up on the streets of Japanese occupied territories. Sometimes they were convinced to travel because they were being offered better paying jobs, like
nursing
jobs.
That's what I was
going
to say. I actually wrote a few different stories down of different women that I'll just kind of refer to throughout the episode of how I learned about their stories. A lot of people would respond to like ads in the paper for jobs. They would say, you know, you can help the military effort by nursing or working in a factory and all these different things. So these young women and girls wanting to help their families would go willingly, thinking that they were going to be doing a job of some sort and then being tricked into sexual slavery.
Right. And these women came from all over Southeast Asia, but the majority were Korean or Chinese. But there are stories of women from the Philippines, women from Malaysia, women from all over this region.
Yeah.
Once they were at the brothels, the women were forced to have sex. They were raped by their captors in brutal inhumane conditions. There's a lot of testimonies, and all of them share a lot of similarities. There were repeated rapes, especially before battles. They increased. There was a lot of physical assaults, pregnancies, sexually transmitted diseases, and also just their living conditions themselves were really horrifying.
Yeah, and that's a hotbed for more, you know, disease and unwellness if you're not going to put them in a clean environment, you know, especially when, like, if you're naked and you're having sex, like, it does need to be clean. So it just kind of shows, again, the lack of concern for the health and well-being of these girls and women.
Right. I mean, and some of these women talk about how they didn't get any breaks either. So, like, between men, which again is a hotbed for, like, disease.
I just thinking about that, just like,
Yeah. And I do also want to point out that while a lot of these women were lured there under the pretense of a job or something like that, there were also, you know, very poor families who basically thought that they were renting their daughters out for a job, not necessarily to be in brothels. And then there was also a good percentage of these women who were straight up kidnapped.
Sold. Oh, I was going to say, yeah, that were straight up kidnapped. Yeah.
Yes. There is a woman named Lee Oxian who was kidnapped in Busan, South Korea by a group of uniformed Japanese soldiers at the age of 14. Mm. And she never saw her parents again. And she told... she was telling her story to a news outlet in 2013 about her experience. And it was just so sad to me because it's just this 14-year-old girl. She's walking home along the side of the road. It happened so fast.
Yeah.
She had no idea what was happening. And then she was held prisoner. And she described it as saying it was no place for humans and that she was being constantly beaten and constantly threatened by her captors.
Yeah.
And an estimated 90% of comfort women did not survive the war. That's how terrible it was.
It was brutal. And there was another woman that I read about by the name of Kim Hexun, and she was born in China, and her stepfather ended up selling her to Japanese soldiers. So there was some kind of, like, you know, selling as well as, you know, kidnapping and other modes of, you know, I guess, recruiting these women.
All of it just horrifying, just so scary. And I just can't imagine.
They're all so young. You know, it's all of these stories and testimonies that I read were all from very, very young women. And I know, you know, I was reading a little bit about, you know, we talked about purity culture in the sense of, you know, Christianity and stuff a couple of weeks ago. But I know that there's also a lot of a very different type of purity culture in Southeast Asian countries. And to think of these young girls and women who probably don't even know what sex is, you know, and are being lured into these situations, having no idea what is going on. Like, that's the thing. When I hear about young girls that are put in these situations, they don't even know how to react because they don't know what's happening to them.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most scary situations that I could ever imagine. I mean, this is one of the worst things that I feel like could happen to you. I think about that in terms of, like, we think about the women in Cleveland, right, who were, like, locked in that house for 10 years.
Ariel Castro, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right? You know, and, like, to me, when I hear stories like that, or, like, the movie Room, for instance, you know, like, to me, that, for me personally, that is my nightmare. Like, that is being kept.
Yes.
Is my biggest fear.
My biggest fear is being abducted, not by aliens, but by people. Like,
by people and being kept.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Like, if you're going to take me, just kill me. I don't want to be trapped in a room somewhere. I don't know. That is, and I think it's crazy. I read so many of those stories. Like, I read so many memoirs of survivors or stories of things like that because I think that's my biggest fear ever.
Right. And I do want to say, because I don't want it to get twisted or confused, this is not to downplay survivors, right?
No,
like,
no,
I don't ever, I don't ever want to say, like, death would be better than.
I'm saying for me. I'm not saying for everybody. I'm saying I'm so scared Like, the thought of that, I would rather die. Like, that's all I'm saying.
I do find the thought of it to be one of the scariest things. And the fact that the women who did survive this managed to survive it and go on to live, in some cases, quite extraordinary lives despite the circumstances is incredible. And I actually think probably... And this is pure speculation on my part. I didn't read anything about this, but I would guess that part of what kept these women going was the fact that they weren't alone, that there were other women there in similar situations.
Yeah, I hope that, you know, even after the war, that these women and girls were able to find other people that had experienced something similar that they could rely upon, because I can imagine going back into society, having survived something like that, would be incredibly isolating and so difficult without proper help.
Well, it was. And we'll talk a little bit about what happened to them after the war, you know, a little later on. But it was incredibly isolating, especially, like, as you said, in their culture, they really didn't discuss these kinds of things. And so, unfortunately, through no fault of their own, you know, having been forced into this situation, when they finally did exit the situation, they were outcasts in a lot of ways because of something that happened to them that they had no real control over.
Yeah, they're really...
Which is another tragedy.
Yeah, I'm not trying to generalize because I don't have the kind of knowledge on this culture or anything, but just from things that I've read for research for this episode, you know, I read a little bit about, I guess, honor culture and things like that, where there is this idea that, you know, we know all too well that the responsibility of the rape is on the woman and not the man. So these women were seen as the problem, you know, not victims.
I mean, we see that even in our culture very often, a lot of that victim blaming, and especially we saw it a lot kind of like earlier on in the 20th century, stuff like that happened a lot where it would be, and we see it a lot in purity culture in Christian communities as well, where there's this concept of you being spoiled, where it's just like you're not pure anymore, even if it's not your fault, which is extremely problematic for obvious reasons.
And having to reconcile that with yourself, knowing that this wasn't your choice, but still probably feeling like it was your fault. Somehow, I'm sure a lot of these women felt like, well, if I hadn't gone out that day, maybe they wouldn't have taken me. If I hadn't have gone to that job, you know, listened to that job ad, you know what I mean? I'm sure that there was so much guilt that they shouldn't have felt, but did feel during and after these events.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it was under such an umbrella of silence for so long, which only breeds more shame and guilt.
Exactly.
You know?
And one of the other things that just broke my heart was the fact that they had so many health issues afterwards because, you know, repeated rape and sexual assault can cause infertility. It can cause a lot of damage to your organs on the inside and lots of other things. So a lot of these women were unable to have children. They were sterile. A lot of times these women, if they were to get pregnant in these brothels, they were forced to have abortions that were not very safe. So a lot of these women would go on the rest of their lives too, where, again, you know, we're talking back in 1940s, like middle of the 40s. So I think that, you know, still to this day, a lot of what women feel is their purpose is birthing children and you know, living that normal life in that way. I can imagine, you know, if they were to get into a relationship with somebody and have to tell them, look, I can't have children because of this.
Right.
Again, that other added level of shame, like I can't even do the thing that I want to do with my body anymore. That was taken from me.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. You weren't given the choice. It's terrible.
Yeah. And the women were also injected with something called Salversan, which was used as a treatment for syphilis. And that, together with the damage to their organs caused by the high number of men that they were exposed to, created this super high number of sterility among those women.
Yes, there were many who were left unable to have children. There were some who were left unable to walk afterwards because of the violent treatment that they had experienced while in the camps. And the end of World War II did not end military brothels in Japan.
No.
In 2007, the Associated Press reported that the United States authorities allowed comfort stations to operate well past the end of the war until Douglas MacArthur shut the system down in 1946. So by then, between 20,000 and 410,000 women had been enslaved in at least 125 brothels. Ugh. And in 1993, the UN's Global Tribunal on Violations of Women's Human Rights estimated that at the end of World War II, 90% of the comfort women had died. And of the ones who survived, as we just discussed, they had lasting health complications. Others had died of venereal diseases after the war. Many lived as societal outcasts, as we said.
Yeah, they were pariahs.
And others completed suicide because of what they had experienced.
Yeah.
So we were left with very few surviving women who had experienced this.
There was something that I read in my notes that I wrote down because it was very impactful to me, but it said, by choosing to live, the survivors made themselves outcasts. You know, it's that bravery in surviving, knowing that you've kind of got that scarlet letter on you.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And meanwhile, Japanese officials destroyed documents on the system and downplayed the story of its enslavement of the women as a distasteful incident, with some officials denying that comfort stations existed at all. It wasn't until the 1980s when some women began to share their stories, because in 1987, the Republic of South Korea became a liberal democracy, and women began to discuss their ordeals more publicly, because a lot of these women had kept in touch with each other because they were social outcasts, and the only other people who would understand what they went through were each other. So they began to speak more openly as a unit about what had happened to them.
And try to get some legal action and compensation. In December of 1991, three South Korean women filed suit in Japan around the 50th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack, which I think is a perfect time to be able to bring up something like this, although it should have been brought up, you know, long before.
So in 1990, that's when South Korea actually came out and criticized Japanese officials' denial of the event. So they came out on a public stage and they were like, look, we know this happened. You know it happened. Stop saying it didn't happen. And the Japanese government was pretty quiet on the matter. But as more and more women came forward in 1993, they were finally forced to acknowledge the atrocities, though they did continue to downplay the severity. They were like, yes, this is a thing that happened, but it wasn't that bad, you know, and they kept trying to say that these women volunteered for this.
Yes. I mean, this was supposed to be a positive PR move in the beginning, and clearly it wasn't. It's almost like they're still trying to continue that facade of trying to change the public's image of this time and the war, you know?
Right. It really felt like they were trying to say, look, this was all on the up and up. There may have been isolated incidents of, you know, bad things happening, or maybe a couple of the women were kidnapped, but the vast majority of the women wanted to be here. They wanted to do this.
Just,
you know,
gaslighting such a large amount of people by doing that, you know?
Yes, it's horrible. So in 2000, and it went on much like this for a long time. There's a lot of tension between, specifically, though it happened in other places, it's been South Korea who's been the most vocal about this.
Yes.
And it's caused a lot of tension between the two nations. Like, they have a lot of issues surrounding this thing in particular, because the Japanese government really, 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 really wants the world to forget that this happened.
Yeah.
You know, and South Korea is like, no, this
we
is
need
fucked
the
up.
World to know that this happened. Yeah, kind of the opposite. So they're kind of pushing pushing Japan to take responsibility and also to finally give these women the apology and the compensation that
they deserve.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly.
So on April 17th, 2007, there was the discovery of seven official documents in the archives of the Tokyo trials, and it suggested that Imperial military forces forced women whose fathers had attacked an army police group in Japan to work in frontline brothels in China, Indonesia, and Indochina. These documents were initially made public at the war crimes trial. So at this point, I mean, we are actually finding official documents that are saying that, like, these women were forced essentially to pay for their father's crimes. They took their daughters and forced them into these brothels. So we're finding official documentation at this point.
Luckily, right. You know.
And then the following month, in May of 2007, there was a Japanese journalist who announced the discovery of 30 Dutch documents submitted to the Tokyo Tribunal as evidence of forced prostitution in 1944. So at this point, it's becoming harder and harder for Japan to deny it. I mean, and in 2014, China also produced almost 90 documents that was ironclad proof that the Japanese military forced Asian women to work in frontline brothels during World War II.
Yeah.
So it's getting real hot and spicy.
I was going to say the Japanese government. More and more people are coming in and closing in on them, you know, to take responsibility. And I think that's great.
Yeah. So as these documents continued to be released, the Japanese government finally announced that it would give reparations to surviving Korean comfort women in 2015. But after a review, South Korea was like, nah, son, this ain't enough. Like, they looked at it and they were like, we need a stronger apology from you.
Yeah.
And Japan denied that request. They were like, look, we offered you something. It felt very much like they were just like, can you just shut the fuck up?
Like, it was something take it. Like a couple hundred bucks per woman or something, right? Like, it was just a very small amount of compensation.
I think it was a pretty small amount of compensation. And also, I think their apology was very, like, surface level apology. It wasn't enough for what they had done. And meanwhile, there's only a few dozen women forced into sexual. And that's another thing. There aren't that many women left. Like, so for you to offer basically nothing to the women who are surviving as a government, you know, when you could offer
so much more.
So much more. It's so wild. But so there's only a few dozen women forced into sexual slavery by Japan are still alive at this point.
Yeah.
And one of them was Yang Su Lee, a 90-year-old survivor who had been very vocal about her desire to receive an apology from the Japanese government. She said, and I think that this sums it up kind of perfectly with what we were talking about with the term comfort women and comfort stations. She said, quote, I never wanted to give comfort to those men.
Exactly.
And that's what she said to the Washington Post in 2015. And she said, I don't want to hate or hold a grudge, but I can never forgive what happened to me. Hmm. You know, and that she's a 90-year-old woman,
exactly.
You know, like just tragic, tragic. So even discussion of comfort women is controversial in Japan. There are advocates in Japan. Like I said, you know, earlier, there are some Japanese journalists who are constantly looking for documents, who are challenging the Japanese government and saying that they have long denied justice to these women. While there are also government supporters that say that there's no evidence that the women were forced into sex slavery, a claim that was made as recently as this year.
Crazy.
And that Japan has already apologized.
Yeah.
They're like, listen.
That weak apology
already apologized.
That's all you're getting. Sorry.
Right. I mean, and it does appear that they did plan on giving something like $8 million to help former comfort women. But it's really not enough. And some people have pointed out that none of Japan's apologies have been official because none have been ratified by the legislature or approved by the executive branch.
Yeah.
And there have been no laws enacted to acknowledge the country's responsibility. So they want to give an apology without actually making it official, like putting it in any kind of official capacity.
Right. And I'm sure, again, that's a way of trying to kind of remove this from history as much as they can, you know, so that people, you know, what we're doing right now is exactly what they don't want people to do, to continue talking about it.
Exactly. Like, so for like 100 years from now, they don't want people to be able to point to any legislature, any actual like documentation.
To say that they take
responsibility. Right. Yeah. Because as recent as this year, there have been people coming forward saying like, we have documents that the women volunteered for this, that they signed paperwork for this. Right. And then they've had to walk that back. But unfortunately, what happens when they do that is it's giving power to people who want to believe the government, right? Uh-huh. Because we know that people don't read more than the headline. So even though there is no actual proof, they're like, well, we think that there's documents that they signed that said that they wanted to be working as sex workers in these military brothels.
Right. So it's not alerting the public in a way that it should, because they're making it sound like, oh, there might be some documents. There, yeah. It's not making the people invested in the story.
Well, it's making the people who want to believe that these atrocities did not happen, it's giving them something to point to say like, well, he's saying that there's documents and I'm not going to read any further into that and just believe that there must be documents, because nobody wants to believe that something as terrible as this could, one, happen, and could, two, be sanctioned by your government. Like, right. People don't want to believe that, you know, like,
yeah, I mean, I think
that this is something that could happen.
I think that's why, you know, we don't talk a whole lot about the internment camps in the United States. I think that is a huge point of shame for our government. And I understand that, you know, a lot of countries in the past that have made mistakes, you know, will try to minimize or not talk about certain atrocities. But because if we don't do that, like we all know, it's just going to continue to happen.
Absolutely. I mean, I would compare, well, it's not quite the same, but I think about our inability as a nation to really address what happened in Guantanamo Bay. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? It's just like, we don't want to believe that we would do something that horrible. And if we did, we want to believe that it was justified in some way.
Yes. Yeah. We don't want to be the bad guys. The only time it's okay to be the bad guy is if you're doing it for the greater good. So to realize that you were just bad, period. I think that's something that's really hard for people to reconcile, especially when you have a lot of like national pride. If you're very proud of where you're from, your culture, mm-hmm. who you are, I can understand admitting that, you know, your government has been responsible for something so ugly. It can be something, I think, very personal for a lot of people. And I think we've seen that a lot, you know, throughout this past year with the election and the insurrection. You know, people take their government and their beliefs in their government very, very seriously and personally.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's hard for people to acknowledge that there's good and there's bad, right? So I think about this a lot of the times with Germany, for instance, right? Yeah. Like when I was a kid, I couldn't wrap my head around how a country that was, in my eyes, responsible for something as horrifying as the Holocaust could have anything else that was positive, right? You know? And the truth of the matter is you're going to find good and horrific in every country's history.
Exactly.
Like there's going to be both, and it doesn't necessarily mean anything about you as a Japanese person,
yes,
right? Like
yes.
that your country committed something that was so heinous, right? And uh-huh. so you should be able, it doesn't say anything about you as a human being to say, this was fucked up, this was wrong. Like our nation owes these people an apology.
Right.
And at bare minimum.
Yeah. And I wonder also, because, you know, when there's a massacre or a war and people are killed and I guess more, or are hurt, I guess, in more like societally accepted ways, like in war and things like that. And this was sexual assault, which I think makes it even more difficult for people to admit, because it is such a shameful thing even to this day. It isn't, you know, I think that there's something about...
Well, I feel like there are rules of war, in quotes. You know what I mean? And like, yes, that seems ridiculous because it's just like war is so ugly. And it feels weird that we should try and justify certain deaths over other deaths or certain atrocities over other atrocities. But there are reasons that there are rules of engagement, and there are reasons that everyone was so horrified by the rape of Nanking. You know what I mean?
And I think
or just going into unarmed innocence
yeah.
and destroying that.
Yeah, like, it's
horrifying,
like,
to people.
And I feel like the discussion of murder or war is something that is much more socially acceptable, you know, seeing it on the news, reading it in the paper, than hearing about details of sexual assault or, you know, forced prostitution and things like that and sexual slavery. You know, it's just not as easily discussed and digested by people, which I think is why people want to deny it even more, you know?
Right. I mean, and there is also this concept of women as being a protected group. Right. Like, because for so long it was like women and children.
Yeah.
Right. These yeah. are off limits. And so these were not only women, but a lot of them were children.
Yeah, it was
and
both.
I think that that was also horrifying to people, was like, these are groups that are off limits. These are groups that are supposed to be protected by society. They're not, even in times of war, we shouldn't be allowed to do these things.
Yeah.
You know, like,
looking
it's
at
an unspoken
that.
Rule. So, Julie Tang, who is a retired San Francisco judge and co-chair of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition, previously told NBC News that there were about 50 Comfort Women alive and that she got involved in a project to establish a memorial in San Francisco in 2015. Today, only about 20 registered South Korean Comfort Women, who are all in their 80s and 90s, are still alive. And this was as of last year, I believe.
Yeah.
So over the last few decades, the U.S. has seen the birth of multiple organizations that have joined the Comfort Women movement. Most, like the Korean American Forum of California, appear to be largely focused on educating the public about the issue rather than pressuring Japan for an apology. So there are some groups that are really pushing and advocating for Japan to make a formal official apology and issue reparations to these women. There are others who are just like, you know what? We're not even going to go down that route. We just really want the public to be aware that this was a thing that happened. And yeah. we need to educate people that this was a thing that happened, you
yeah,
know,
I
like so that it doesn't get forgotten.
Right. If the government isn't going to do what it should do and give a proper apology and acknowledge what happened, then, yeah, it is the responsibility of civilians to continue to tell the story and to talk about it so that, you know,
yes.
it doesn't happen.
Yes, but the Japanese government is even trying to prevent that from happening.
Yeah.
So Comfort Women memorials have continued to go up all across the world, including in 10 cities across the United States, with one of the biggest ones being the one in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
However, Japan has tried to remove and block Comfort Women memorials across the globe. In 2017, the Japanese government filed a brief in support of a lawsuit seeking the removal of a memorial in a Los Angeles suburb. Later that year, the mayor of Osaka, Japan, terminated Osaka's sister city relationship with San Francisco after it became, according to activists, the first major city to install a memorial statue. And it has also, Japan has also eliminated Comfort Women from Japanese textbooks.
Ugh.
So it is doing everything in its power. I mean, it has been a real kind of back and forth, even with the relationship of the United States and Japan.
Definitely.
For instance, there was supposed to be a memorial that went up in Atlanta, but the Japanese government blocked that and it ended up having to go up in a smaller city outside of Atlanta. But the activists there in Atlanta actually said, you know what, this was actually good for us because we got so much more attention
right.
By them trying to prevent this statue from going up
yeah.
than we ever would have gotten before.
Well,
and so
what,
now more people know.
And that's what I was thinking when I was reading about so much of the current stuff that's going on. It's like, why haven't we heard more about this? I do recall, I believe I've seen the Comfort Women statue when I was in mm-hmm. San Francisco, but I was not aware of the tensions surrounding this story at all. I'm amazed mm-hmm. that it isn't discussed more in the news.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. But there is some good news. So high school and college students have joined the fight for justice for Comfort Women by forming their own groups to inform their peers and even contribute financially to survivors. This warmed my heart
so much.
It
warms mine too. I know.
In Massachusetts, four schools based mostly in Boston formed a loose association in the spring of 2018 that led to a screening of a film based on a Comfort Woman story called I Can Speak, yeah, and donated $6,000 to House of Sharing, a South Korean nursing home for Comfort Women.
That's the thing, is like, if your government is going to let you down, I love to see that there's so many good people in the world,
absolutely,
that are willing to step up and make it right, to show like, look, we're not all going to turn our backs on you. You know, we see, right, you, and we want to support you.
Right. And $6,000, it's not a lot of money, but it's incredible that they cared enough to do that.
Like, yeah, are just students, you know, these, yeah, are just people that cared so much, and $6,000 is huge. I mean, I remember when I was young, my mom had a friend who was going through a really bad divorce and financially really struggling, and I always would like sell jewelry or painted rocks and just crazy stuff like on my street corner, and I remember making like $500 one summer. And my friend and I that did it were like, what are we going to do with this money? Like, how are we going to spend it? And we ended up giving it to him. It's $500. It's not going to get him very far. But it was something that meant a lot to him still, because,
yes, you know, absolutely,
people that cared about him were willing to give something. You know?
And I think that that means more than the money itself,
exactly,
right? It's the fact that you have this group of American students on the other side of the globe from you who heard your story, were moved so much by your story, and wanted to show you that, like, we see you, right? And, like, we're there for you. And I also wanted to point out, you know, the fact that there's even a nursing home for Comfort Women that exists.
That's amazing.
It's incredible. It's incredible. And I'm glad that it exists and they have each other.
I know.
But it also is sad, because what it points to is that they were so outcast, yep, by society, that even through their old age, this is something that has defined their lives,
yeah,
from the time they were children.
Yeah. Basically. I wonder if it's a choice for them to want to be in a one of those nursing homes, or if they would, mm-hmm, rather be in a regular home. But because of what they went through, they wouldn't be treated right. You know what I mean? Like, that's really,
right,
sad to me, that maybe they would have to go to a special, you know, assisted living center because of
I'm
what
glad
they
it exists.
Through. I'm glad it exists,
absolutely,
but it also makes me so sad that,
yeah,
even in the last years of your life, you're not able to really mesh with the rest of society.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that this is a thing that, unfortunately, their lives were pushed entirely off course,
yeah,
because of this thing that happened to them that they had no control over,
and
like,
sure,
that is,
yeah,
so sad.
And I'm sure that there's also fear that if they were to go to maybe more of just like a general population home of some sort, that maybe they wouldn't receive the same treatment as everybody else. I feel like
it's
that
possible.
Would be a concern for me. Hopefully, mm-hmm, the people at the quote-unquote Comfort Women nursing homes or facilities are there with a lot of knowledge and care and know how to help these women in the last years of their lives.
It does seem as though in South Korea, at least, and especially in the last, you know, 20 years,
yeah,
that they have been very much on their side,
yeah,
and advocating for them. And I really do think it speaks to the power of being vocal,
uh-huh,
about these things, right? They took their power back in being able to share their stories in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Because it did give them allies, right? They're going to have people who criticize them, and that's got to be super difficult.
So
and if
hard.
They never wanted to talk about it again, I would completely understand it. But to those who felt like they could talk about it and wanted to share their stories, it gave them a little bit of their power back,
totally,
right? You,
yeah,
know,
completely.
And I think that that's an amazing thing. There was also a group at Crescenta Valley High School in Southern California who raised money to send care packages to that same nursing home and wrote letters to the remaining Comfort Women.
I love that. Did you ever
do pen pals
with nursing homes in school?
I didn't do that, but I did used to live like really close to a nursing home whenever I lived in Missouri, and we would go every Halloween and like walk through the nursing home
and
because
get candy.
Yes, because I want to encourage people to do that. Like, you should look into programs to see if that's something, if you have young children, or, you know, you just want to go visit, because oftentimes they look forward to visitors and they'll sit outside their doors with candy.
Yeah.
And they want to see kids like come in their costumes. And it's really something that can brighten their day.
Right. So we lived around the corner from a nursing home, Max and I, in our first apartment together. And I remember running into a woman and her like very young baby, but like maybe a year old, year and a half. And they had just gone and dropped off cards at the nursing home, which I thought was so sweet. But I think I was probably in like third or fourth grade, and we each got a member of a nursing home, and they were our pen pals throughout like the whole year. And then at the end of the year, we had like a big party where everyone had their pen pal come and meet. And
I love that.
Like a big lunch and desserts and pictures together. And it was so cool because I felt like I had made this really, really awesome friend. It was great.
Yeah. I mean, I really do think that in our country, in the United States, we don't value our elderly the way that we should.
Yeah.
Because you can learn so much. It's so incredible to talk to somebody who has seen that much life, right? You know,
and I do think that is that's something that Southeast Asian countries do really well. I think for the most
in
part,
general,
there is like a lot of respect for elders, where I feel like in the United States, once you've hit a certain age, you're just kind of like, ship you off somewhere. We don't want to have to worry about you anymore.
Well, yeah. I mean, and we're getting a little off course, but I do want to say this because it's something that I've been thinking about. Like, I think that that stems a lot from consumerist capitalist culture, where your only value lies in what you can do. And so when you no longer become physically useful to the capitalist machine, then you're no longer valuable, right? And so it's just kind of like you can't work anymore, so what do we need you for?
Yeah, and
you
know what I mean? I think that does still tie in with what we're talking about, though, because I think that it's so important to treat survivors and to treat our elderly with such respect. I mean, I can't imagine what these women have been through. I don't know how much treatment and therapy they've been through. I mean, I can't imagine still living with so much hurt, you know? And so talking about that respect, I think, is really important.
I don't know how you go on. I think that there's so much strength in being able to go on living after that, because I'm just trying to think in my brain about how jarring it would be. You have a very sudden change of course, especially for the women who were abducted, right? You're just going about your day. You don't expect that night you're going to be imprisoned, and that you're going to be imprisoned in some cases for several years. And then as suddenly as it began, it's over.
Yeah.
And nobody is acknowledging that this is a thing that's happened to you. So, or if they are acknowledging it, it's in a really negative way.
Yeah.
So how are you supposed to pick up the pieces of your life and move on?
Yeah.
You know, it would be really hard.
It would be
so hard.
You know, and there's something that, you know, whenever sexual assault is discussed, I hear a lot of, you know, the body remembers. It's one of those things that doesn't really ever leave you. And so, I mean, I guess this is the time for me to encourage anybody who knows somebody who has been sexually assaulted, if you have been sexually assaulted yourself, the importance of getting help and therapy and talking to someone about it is so, so important.
Yeah, absolutely. So I did want to point out that the Korean American Forum of California did successfully campaign for the inclusion of comfort women in a history social science framework. So California adopted that in 2016. The year before that, the San Francisco Board of Education approved a resolution to teach staff and students about human trafficking, including the history of comfort women.
Yes.
And last year, there was a group, the Korean American Forum of California, they created a Comfort Women Teacher's Guide that has been distributed this year free to schools across California.
That's great for California. Like, all of
California,
that is California. Yeah. That sounds fantastic. I hope that we can get to a place where all over the country and all over the world, this can be discussed with less fear and shame,
stigma
and talk about it, because it's so, like, none of this. I didn't know about any of this growing up in school. None sexual assaults and mass rapes, none of that was discussed. And I think it's thought of being a way to shield us from pain. You know, if they don't know about it, then maybe, you know, they won't be scared of it or it won't happen. But that's just not the case.
I also feel like we have to, as a country, stop conflating. First of all, we need to move away from this puritanical belief around sex in general, because I feel like people don't want to discuss it in schools with children because they see it as a sexual thing. Yeah. So first of all, we need to move away from not talking about sex with kids. But then secondly, we need to stop conflating rape with sex.
Yes.
Because this isn't sex, it's sexual violence.
Exactly.
It's violence.
Exactly.
Right? And so I think that that is something that needs to be discussed more openly. Maybe if we had these conversations
then the stigma
with
will
kids
go down.
Younger. Yeah. And also maybe rapes would go
exactly.
down. Because if you really pointed out how horrifying rape
yes.
is to kids younger, at a younger age, and this is a very extreme example of
yeah.
that, maybe it wouldn't happen as
exactly.
much. You know what
exactly.
I mean? Because
it's the same thing with talking about how teaching consent needs to be a thing in schools. You know, all of this is so important. You know, we cannot learn if we don't, or we can't change if we don't learn about the mistakes that we've made in the past. And if we just keep pushing them down and pretending that it doesn't happen, like I keep saying, you're giving more and more leeway for these atrocities to continue to happen and continue to be pushed down and not talked about.
Absolutely. So I am really glad that we covered this topic. I was really fascinated by it. You know, I finished my prep. I'll be honest, on this podcast, there are some weeks that are easier to prep for than
yeah.
others. And while this was a emotionally taxing prep, it was not difficult for me because I was so interested in wanting to hear these women's stories.
Definitely.
And wanting to know more about this situation, because I'd known about it on a very kind of like surface
right.
level in like my periphery, but I'd never actually taken the time to figure it out, like what it really was about. And it was so much worse than I had actually expected it to
right,
be.
Right. And I mean, I would really encourage our listeners also, if you go on the Wikipedia page at the bottom, there's, you know, a list of survivors and their pages where you can read about them and what they've done since then. And that was one of my favorite parts. You know, I didn't really go into these individual women much, and I appreciate you, Keegan, for helping me so much on this episode because I feel like an airhead right now. But I would really encourage everybody to go read some of these individual testimonies and stories if it feels like it's something that you can handle, because really the strength of these women and truly understanding their experience, I think, is very important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So thank you all for going on this ride
yeah,
with us
thank
today.
You for putting up with me. I feel like I was in a daze this entire episode.
Oh, you're fine. Look, we've all been there for sure. Like, we have all been there. And allergies can be the worst.
Yeah.
And you never realize how grateful you should be for your healthy body whenever
yep.
you're sick, like more than whenever
exactly.
you're sick. Because when you're sick, you're just like, man, I remember when I could breathe. Wasn't that a nice time?
The simplest of things, yeah. And my body sucks so much that if I'm stuffy for too long, I'll get a sinus infection. So I'm really hoping that I start feeling better soon and don't get sicker instead.
Yeah.
So thank you, Keegan, for being supportive of me through this episode.
Of course.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for listening. If there's anything that you want to write us in about, please do. We're going to be talking about this more, but we are going to be doing a coming out episode for the last week of June. So we would love for you to start sending in your stories if you feel comfortable. Again, if you would like to remain anonymous, you will remain anonymous. We will not use your name. So if there's anything you'd like to send in to us, please email us at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com. Or direct message us on Instagram at Angry Neighborhood Feminist. We have a Facebook business and group page. You can go over to the business page and like us and leave a review and go to the group page and chat with the other listeners. And if you haven't already, it means the absolute world to us when you leave us a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. All right, that's all my voice can handle today. With all of that being said, we encourage you
to rage on.